everybody. It's Dawn Sarah with Sex Gets Real. This week is going to be an incredible episode of deep dives into, well, some of my favorite things and also some things that I don't know about. Because with me this week is the amazing Sarah Miller. So hello, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Sarah is the lead research and education developer at the Smitten Kitten. She's also a sex educator at Smitten Kitten, which is an amazing feminist sex positive shop in Minnesota. And they have a huge online presence too. So definitely go check them out and do a little bit of shopping. But Sarah, what really got me was your lube presentation that you've been doing at a couple of conferences. And so I would love to start with us talking about lube because everybody needs it. And I think there's this quote that you have for the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit that I love. So I'm going to read it and then I think we can just dive in.
Okay.
So your quote was, "Finding the right lube is like finding the right partner. It makes any sexual activity better, safer, and more pleasurable, and is a very subjective personal choice."
Yeah.
So what got you so excited and interested in lube?
Part of it was kind of my own struggle with finding a lubricant that I liked to use. Before I even worked as a sex educator and before I worked at the Smitten Kitten, I had really only used kind of the obvious lubricants out there that you can get at like CVS or a grocery store. And they never really agreed with my body. And I always assumed it was something wrong with my body. And I have diabetes, so I do have some vaginal complications that come along with diabetes, and I kind of like lumped it into that pile of things that I was going through with my own health, and then I started working at the Smitten Kitten and got some lube from there, and I was like, oh, this is great, like, what's the difference? And so I started this little project at the Smitten Kitten that was supposed to end up just being a spreadsheet that would be a reference for our staff of sex educators. That kind of broke down the different lubes we carried and said things about condom compatibility and whether or not they were good for folks who are trying to conceive and like what may be the most potentially irritating ingredient in a lubricant would be, and broke down also some of the like common allergies that people have. And as I was trying to get more information to fill out this chart, I realized that there were a lot of ingredients that were being used in personal lubricants that had never been tested on human genitals, that had not so great safety profiles. And then I really started digging into it and realizing that it was going to turn into a much bigger project when I started trying to piece things together, because a lot of the lubes that we carry at the Smitten Kitten aren't the big lubes that you would find in a grocery store or in a convenience store. They're smaller brands making like more organic lubricants. And so those formulas themselves had never been tested as whole ingredient formulas in documented scientific studies or journal publications. And so then I tried to kind of figure out like, well, what do the individual ingredients do to the genitals? And then I realized I had to really understand the mucous membranes of the genitals and how those function. And it snowballed into 2.5 years of lube research. So it wasn't that I kind of thought that I was going to become the lube person, that wasn't the plan. But then I was really interested, and I kind of have a obsessive mind anyways, so when I get going on something, I have to know all the things about it, and so that's really what I've been doing with lube. And now a couple other topics are like filtering into that kind of obsession, but it's been really interesting and really great, and also really scary and really frustrating, because I feel like the right information isn't making it to the right people who are really the people talking to folks about lubricants and the importance of lubricants. And then there's some things that are just scary, and that some lubes are actually really bad for the body and can increase potential for STI contraction or transmission, or really any sort of pathogen getting through the barriers of the skin. So I hope to like keep talking to people about lube for a long time. And there are some newer studies that have come out since I started doing my presentation about lube that have been really validating because I don't have a science background. Mm-hmm. So it's also, I always check my work with my brother, who's a molecular biologist, which is really handy.
I was going to say, that's a handy family member.
Right? Yeah, it turned out great. But it's also been cool to see kind of other studies coming out saying what I'm saying, but there's the experts in the chemistry and the microbiology. So that's been cool. And kind of fleshing it out even more and figuring out more about different ingredients, different formulas, and how they interact with the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that we talk a lot about on the show is not only the importance of having lube on hand, but also having a variety of lubes, depending mm-hmm. on the different activities you're doing or what kinds of safer sex protocols you're following, and also finding one that really fits with your body. And I'd love to know, are there any like specific lubes or specific things that people should absolutely avoid?
Yes. KY is just not good. And KY, this is a tricky thing too. I think when a lot of people talk about lube, they talk in brand names without necessarily realizing that that brand probably makes 4 to 20 different products.
Yeah.
So there are products that KY makes that are not terrible things. But KY liquid, KY jelly, they're water-based lubricants, are just not good for mucous membranes. So that's the rectum, the vulva, the vagina, and a little bit the urethra. But for most folks, lube doesn't get in there a lot, mm-hmm. Enough to cause a reaction anyways. But I would say that is not great. But really, that's a good example of the ingredients you should avoid, because I know propylene glycol and glycerin are the two ingredients that I would say everyone should avoid in a water-based lubricant. Mm-hmm. And those are like the first two ingredients in most KY products, or in the first three, including water. Astroglide also has a lot of lubes where those are in the first couple of ingredients.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because those ingredients indicate that lubricant is what we call hyperosmolar, which just means there's a lot of things dissolved in the liquid that is the base of the lube, and that can cause the mucus to dry up. It can cause dehydration of the skin, which can lead to skin cell death, which just leaves those mucous membranes really, really vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I would also always just kind of, there's nothing objectively wrong with warming or sensation-inducing lube, or necessarily numbing lube, but those are things that I think a lot of people, still a minority, but a lot of people have reactions to. So if you have sensitive skin, I think it's good to avoid those, just because they are a little bit riskier. And then the numbing lube is kind of one of those things that you want to use really particularly and responsibly, because if you numb pain, that isn't a good thing. For some people, there are really legitimate and responsible ways to use numbing lubricants, but mm-hmm. the numbing agents are irritants and allergens, and there's also a really important message coming to you from your body when you're experiencing pain. So being able to pay attention to that is a good thing.
You know, what struck me as you were saying KY is every time I've been at the OBGYN, they pull out the KY to lube up their tools.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, do you take your own lube?
I have taken my own lube. I also sometimes, depending on what's happening with my body and with a particular exam, will just ask to not use lube. KY is actually based off of the formula for Sergilube, which is Sergilube, or a generic brand of Sergilube, is what most medical professionals use for a lubricant. Mm-hmm. And it's a sterile lubricant, which is used for, yes, like speculums and during a pelvic exam, but also for syringes and for catheterization. So there's certain applications of SurgiLube where it really makes sense to have a sterile lubricant, but the ingredient that causes that lube to be sterile as well as KY to be sterile is called chlorhexidine gluconate. And that is an antiseptic that is really harsh and is actually really terrible for genitals. It can cause a lot of irritation, especially if there's already any sort of lesions or breakages in the skin. But it also kills the healthy bacteria that lives inside of your body. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people have told me that they get irritated after pap smears, and they always thought that it was from the scraping or from the speculum, and really it's from the lubricant. And so that's a fairly common thing. But medical professionals are in a little bit of a tricky situation because certain tests require that you use either no lube or a specific lube so it doesn't impact the testing mechanisms later on. And also just they're on a budget. Like I've talked to a lot of healthcare professionals that I've taught my class to, and they really want to get a different kind of lube and will ask me for recommendations about what they can buy in bulk and what they can buy through medical supply stores. And there's definitely options that are better than SurgiLube, but there's no option that I would be like, this is a lube I would recommend to a person who walked into the store at the Smitten Kitten. You know, like there's still this lack of availability of a lot of the lubes that are actually body friendly.
Yeah. So have you found anything that's really helpful for if you do have a reaction to a lube that you've been using, how to kind of get your body back to a more healthy place as far as the tissues go?
I think that would really depend on what the reaction is. If it's just irritation, I would say to stop using that lube and give your body a couple days to right itself. And usually that would be fine. I think that if there is ongoing irritation and it seems like it's just a kind of skin irritation, that using something that's a little bit more gentle and a little bit more hydrating, like a coconut oil actually would probably be pretty good. And then for other things, like lube can lead to yeast overgrowth, can lead to bacterial vaginosis or a UTI. And there are a lot of, I don't like to make healthcare recommendations in those cases, because there's a lot of really great homeopathic remedies for those things that work for some people and feel good to do for some people. And for other people, that's just not their realm, or they're not interested in that, and they're going to go see a healthcare professional and get treatment that way. So I would just say, like, treat that the way you would treat other health issues. I think that a lot of people's common sense kind of stops at their genitals. It's like a whole new set of rules when it comes to sex and their genitals. And really, sexual health is part of your overall holistic health. It's all interconnected. It's not like a separate thing. So just take care of your body in the way that feels good to you. And also just like knowing that lube can cause these things, I think, is a really big deal, because a lot of folks will just blame their body or their partner's body. And oftentimes it's a sex toy or it's a lube or it's something external that you're putting inside your body that just isn't safe for it. So
Yeah, it's really interesting, because for years I would go to like the Pride Festival or the Pride Parade, and I'd get all of these samples of like lubes and condoms, and then I'd go home and I'd use them. And in so many of the brands, specifically for me, Astroglide and Wet, I would end up with this like burning sensation. And it felt really disheartening, because I felt like I was trying to use lube to enjoy myself and then having this bad reaction, but not really knowing where to turn. And, you know, I really want to try and support companies now who their entire line of products is devoted to being as safe as possible and as body safe as possible. And, you know, I know that not all of the lubes that KY carries or all of the lubes that Astroglide carries are like, I'll use quotes, but like bad, but I'd rather support a company who's putting as much as they can into the lubes that they're creating, being really high quality lubes.
Right.
And I mean, what would you recommend as far as people who maybe don't have a lot of money to spend, but want to try and find some lubes that are a little bit better for their body?
I think Fliquid is a pretty great company that makes a lot of different kinds of lube. They're just launching an oil-based lube, which I'm pretty excited to check out. I haven't actually seen it in person, but the ingredients list is good. So Fliquid, I think, is probably the brand that I recommend the most, especially that's on the affordable end of things. I think that their packaging is misleading, I guess. So that is one thing. One thing that I tell people that often blows their minds is no water-based lube is actually 100% organic. Some of them are like 99%, but really they only need to be 85% organic. And Fliquid, this is why I bring it up, Fliquid has an organics line. And I think that is a misleading name for that line, because those lubes are not even that organic. They have organic botanical extracts in them. But that doesn't mean they're not, like, lube doesn't have to be organic to be good. It doesn't mean they're not good lubes. I just wish that they were a little bit more transparent.
Yeah.
And they just have such a wide variety of products that I really think most folks are going to be able to find one that they like, a consistency that they like. They make silicones and hybrids and water-based and now an oil-based. So that's really great. I also really like Water Slide Lube, which is fairly affordable. It's just not the most widely available product. And I really like that one because it has really minimal ingredients. It has like 3 ingredients. It's fairly thin, but it's one that is kind of a go-to for the Smitten Kitten to recommend to folks who have sensitive skin. And I do like Blossom Organics is one that, like, personally isn't my favorite lube to use, but it is a lot more widely available and a lot more body friendly than a lot of other lubes that you could find in like CVS. And so that's when you can go to Walgreens, you can go to CVS and get that without having to go to a specialty sex toy store or go online to purchase, and is, I think, 85% organic and pretty gentle, pretty good for your body as far as water-based lubes go. My favorite water-based lube right now is called Sutil, and that's made by Hathor Aphrodisia that also makes the Hathor lube. And that one I think is really, really great, but is not being sold in a lot of places and isn't the most affordable, but that's definitely my favorite lube that exists at the moment. I go through your lube phases as far as my personal preference goes.
Yes, I'm addicted to Uber Lube right now.
Yeah, and that's a great product. And I think that one thing that a lot of people don't understand or misunderstand silicone lube. And I think that that's one that it's a little bit more expensive, but it lasts longer than a water base. And at this point, you can pretty much find it anywhere. You would find any kind of lube. So especially if you have really sensitive skin, silicone lube is actually a really, really good way to go as opposed to water based. And it isn't always compatible with a solid silicone sex toy, but that's really the only drawback. And it is also considered hypoallergenic. So that's a really great thing that you couldn't say about any other kind of lube. There are still probably about 1% or less of folks who have some sort of reaction to a silicone-based lubricant, but it's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I knew that silicone lubes and silicone toys sometimes don't really gel, and or maybe they do gel, and that's the problem. But, you know, I was putting condoms on my toys and then using all the lube. And then someone mentioned to me, well, the condoms you're using have silicone lube. And I thought, oh my God, but I haven't had any issues. And I think part of it is because I have really high quality, like medical grade silicone toys. And I'm not using more like the Vicks Skin, which I know people have had issues with. Do you have any experience with like silicone and silicone that does work? Or should everyone just kind of do a spot test and decide for themselves?
I would always say for people to do a spot test and decide for themselves, because even though like I do have experience with it working and being totally fine, people, companies, they change their ingredients lists. Companies will change how they do their silicone formulas without letting you know ahead of time. So that's something that I would say, because the chemistry of how a silicone lube can bond onto the surface of the silicone toy is so isn't reflected in anything that would show up on packaging ingredients. It's about the ion stability, you know, so mm-hmm. there's really no way for most humans to predict that. So that I would say that, to do a spot check whenever you're using a new brand of lube with a new brand of silicone toy. I know that Tantus silicone and pure silicone lube are supposed to be compatible together, and I've never had an issue with using those two together. I've also used pure silicone lube on Happy Valley infused toys and not had an issue with that. And also, I know one of my coworkers put silicone lube all over their Vixen Creations toys, whether they're dual density or single density. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure which brand. I think that he uses primarily Uber Lube, but also the pure backdoor with jojoba oil in it, and hasn't had any issues with that. But I kind of think that he's just magic because other people have had issues with that. And one thing, too, about the condom thing, yeah, most condoms are lubricated with silicone-based lube. If they're pre-lubricated and they don't specify the kind of lube, it's going to be silicone-based lube. But what I've found is that they aren't buying lube somebody else made and putting it on the condoms. They're probably using a really, really pure silicone. So where you see a silicone-based lube usually has 2 to 4 ingredients, the lube that's on condoms is like one ingredient. So generally, it's not just that like you're using high quality medical grade silicone toys. It's that silicone is a really pure, simple silicone on the condom. So the silicone that comes on most condoms, the silicone lube that comes on most condoms is pretty safe mm-hmm. With the silicone sex toys. As in my experience, I've never had an issue with a condoms lube and a toy, but I'm sure someone somewhere has, so I can't say that that's always a rule, but it's usually fine.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh. See, I'm learning something new, which is mm-hmm. the best thing ever. So I have one last question about lube before we move mm-hmm. on, because there's other amazing things I want us to dig into. But
yeah.
If you kind of have like one takeaway for folks who maybe aren't sex educators and maybe don't have a sex positive shop near them, but they really want to have a lube to enhance their sexual experiences, like what's the one takeaway that you would just really want all of the listeners to know?
Don't give up. keep trying different lubes, because really I believe that everybody can find a lube that really works for them, or multiple lubes that work for the multiple things that they do. But it might not be easy. It might not be the first 4 that you even try, but just to value your pleasure and your health enough to stick with it until you find one that you really like and that works for you and your partner or partners, and performs the way that you want it to and interacts with your body the way that you want it to. I think that's one thing that I say a lot, and it sounds sort of cheesy, and a lot of people just don't value lube mm-hmm. the way that I do. But I really think that if you want a good lube, or you need a good lube, which a lot of folks need lube to have pleasurable sex the way they want to have sex, you just got to stick with it until you find one that works, and that there are people like me and other sex educators who can help you do that. So you mm-hmm. don't have to do it alone. You can reach out to people who know a lot about this, or even just know a little bit about this, but maybe know more about what options are available out there in the world. So that would be the one thing that I would want everyone to know.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been really helpful for me is going into shops like Lotus Blooms or Shebop, or you know, the Smitten Kitten and feminist informed shops, is I've found that many of them carry the smaller little like $1 or $2 samples mm-hmm. so that you can kind of see which ones work best for your body. And that's given me an opportunity to try all different kinds of lubes, oil-based and water-based and silicone, and kind of see what I like. And that's what got me hooked on Uber Lube, as they sent me some samples and then I loved it for all the things. But
yeah,
you know, that's something else is you don't have to spend $25 on a bottle of lube that you're not sure about. There's lots of different ways to get either smaller bottles or sample packets. And I think that's a really great way to experiment too.
Definitely. And at Smitten Kitten, we do sell those little trial samples, and we sell lube sampler kits on our website, so you can try a bunch of different ones, and then you can go back to that product page on our website and remember which ones they were when you decide which one you want to buy, which is helpful.
That's very helpful, because God knows I've tried a lube and then thrown the package away and then thought, well, crap, I have no idea what that was. But
that happens all the time.
Okay, so I'd love to shift gears. We are going to talk about herpes and bacterial vaginosis. And I've had this listener question about bacterial vaginosis for 2 months now, just kind of waiting. And so if you're up for it, I'd love to read this and for us to kind of dig into this a little bit.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, so it's from I'm Yeasty, and the subject is bacterial vaginosis help. And it says, "Hi, Dawn. I was recently diagnosed with bacterial vaginosis. It's an imbalance of the bacteria, similar to a yeast infection, but the balance of the bacteria is off. I've gone through 2 different antibiotic treatments, and I'm still having trouble getting rid of this. I've searched online, and there's tons of horror stories of this being a lifelong issue. It's something I've never come across. Some of the symptoms that are worse are pain and itching inside the vagina, overheating of the genitals, a discharge. And I was wondering, does anyone have similar experiences, and is there a way to get rid of this? It's been going on for a month, and it's driving me up a wall. I'm being constantly in pain, and I can't fix it. There's tons of home remedies, but they're scary, and I'm not sure what to try. Things like douching with hydrogen peroxide, or placing a tampon with yogurt inside for 30 minutes. It just sounds crazy. I really don't want that in my vajayjay. Any help you can lend would be terrific. Thanks."
Yeah.
So. Well,
my first reaction to this is, you are not alone. I am Yeasty. This is a thing. This is a thing that a lot of people with vaginas experience. Most folks who get diagnosed with bacterial vaginosis and go through the standard treatment with antibiotics do have a recurrence of bacterial vaginosis. Within, I think, definitely within 6 months, there's probably some wiggle room on either side of that. But the treatment that we have, the medical world, like, knows it's not perfect and knows that it doesn't cure bacterial vaginosis for a lifetime. And there is a lot of factors that go into bacterial vaginosis and its treatment. And so there might be some other things that you can try that might be really helpful. But I can't say for sure what's going to be helpful for, like, any one individual, because it does seem that there's more we don't know than what we do know right now, as far as efficacy of the different treatments. But I think that there's definitely merit to things like a yogurt-soaked tampon being inserted inside the vagina because of the different enzymes and the different proteins that and the microbiotics of yogurt. But if that sounds scary, there's other options. There's oral probiotics that are designed for, like, vaginal wellness and balance. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a co-op near you or a more, like, natural wellness kind of shop, they will probably have those kinds of probiotics that you can take orally that can really impact genital health. Things like smoking cigarettes, your diet, your level of hydration, how much you exercise, all of those things impact vaginal health, and particularly bacterial vaginosis. There's a lot you can do and there's a lot you can try. However, there's still a sizable amount of people who struggle with bacterial vaginosis in an ongoing way because the conventional oral antibiotics don't necessarily do the trick, especially on the long term. Those antibiotics also often lead to yeast infection afterwards, which is kind of this horrible cyclical thing that you can put your body through, or you can decide not to.
Yeah.
And for some folks, that reaction is more pronounced. Like, for me, if I go on antibiotics, I just know it's going to happen. It's inevitable. For some people, it isn't like that. So it really just depends on how your body's set up. And there's also doctors that I've heard of prescribing ongoing antibiotics for months at a time for bacterial vaginosis. And that's one thing that I would not recommend. I don't think that's good for your body. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that that doesn't actually cure the bacterial vaginosis, that it's still very, very common for it to come back whenever you stop those antibiotics. So I think that this isn't really helpful right now, but I think that within the next five years or less, we're going to learn a lot more about mm-hmm. bacterial vaginosis and hopefully figure out how to treat it more effectively. However, right now, there's not a lot of conclusive evidence about like a cure or a standardized way to treat BV mm-hmm. that doesn't lead to recurrence.
And I know what was interesting is I posed this question in a sex educator group that we're both members of and got, mm-hmm. I got 24 comments from other sex educators who all had experience with this and were struggling with the antibiotic cycles and recommended mm-hmm. all different kinds of probiotics. And so that just told me this is, one, a very common problem, and two, something that everyone's kind of trying to figure out.
It's a hugely common problem, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of interesting kind of social cultural factors that I think kind of go along with this. So there are things that maybe seem really obvious to me, but then I have to step back from my weird sex educator world and be like, oh, these aren't. So one thing that like could, if you are using a toxic sex toy or a porous sex toy, that could be reinfecting you over and over. If you're using a lube that causes irritation, that could be exacerbating the BV. Mm-hmm. And sometimes too, there's issues with a partner. Mm-hmm. So sometimes even if you just add barriers, dental dams or condoms or whatever makes sense for how you do sex stuff, adding barriers in when you're having these kind of issues can maybe help, or help you at least isolate, is this a thing that has to do with my partner's body mm-hmm. or not? So,
yeah. And I'll just say, I know that it's very personal because all of our bodies are so different, but a number of people in the thread definitely recommended like cutting back on sugars and just making sure that you're eating a diet that's a lot more balanced so that you're not introducing opportunities for yeast growth. And I personally have used oral probiotics in the past to help with yeast infections after a series of antibiotic treatments, you know, because mm-hmm. yay, antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And that really helped for me. And so, you know, I think one of the things that you said that's just so important is to I'm yeasty, you know, you shouldn't have to do something that feels scary to you. But at the same time, if there's a way to find something that feels good, or if you can go talk to somebody like a naturopath or even just an open-minded doctor, like I know my doctor is very open-minded to trying herbal treatments and natural treatments in addition to prescription medications. And so we've been able to have some really wonderful discussions about what might be right for my body and things to watch out for. So just finding a doctor who's very sex positive and willing to kind of think outside the prescription box can be really helpful.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think one thing too that I like to stress to people is if you're for anything like an STI or BV or stuff that is primarily focused at your genitals and around sexual health, if you're going to your general practitioner or a doctor that doesn't specialize in that for most things, that's fine if you're comfortable with them. But when you have something that becomes an ongoing issue, I really stress that you see somebody who specializes in that mm-hmm. And who is open-minded and is willing to have conversations with you about it. Because the more up-to-date your medical professional's knowledge is, the better your treatment is probably going to be. And when someone doesn't have that area of specialty, they often don't keep their knowledge very up-to-date on mm-hmm. on those little things that don't come up a lot for their line of work. So there's certain things about the diagnosis of bacterial vaginosis that are actually very subjective. So getting a second opinion or seeing a different, more specialized doctor can be really helpful, because they might have a different idea based on how they interpret your test results. Particularly with BV, those are very subjective. With STIs, the testing is a little bit more black and white. Mm-hmm. But there's also things like TRIC that have a really, really similar manifestation in the body to bacterial vaginosis. And they can be co-occurrent, but they also can be misdiagnosed. So making sure that you have either a second opinion or a specialist's opinion, I think, is really important, especially when you get into this ongoing problem that's not going away.
And I would just add that as you're kind of on this journey of trying things and creating this new relationship with your body to learn how to navigate your BV, if you can find support groups for people who are going through the same thing, or if you can surround yourself with people who are really empathetic, I think that that does so much for helping to reduce just like the mental stress and the defeat and the pain in knowing like people have my back, there's other people out there going through this. And so I would encourage you to try and find something like that as well, just so you feel supported on the days when you're just feeling really frustrated or alone.
Oh, totally. I think that that's a huge thing. I think there's a really big mental impact, especially for folks with vaginas, when something is off. And there's this kind of mentality that we can't talk about it. Mm-hmm. But really, the huge majority of people with vaginas have had something like this happen. And they always want to talk about it when you bring it up. It's just hard to get to that point. So definitely reach out, and people will totally support you. One other thing I wanted to add really quick is cooling can actually be really helpful for symptom relief. Whether it's externally or internally, using something cooling, it can help reduce inflammation and speed the skin regeneration. So we actually sell a thing called the SheePack at the Smitten Kitten, which was invented by a friend of the store's who lives in Minneapolis, who's great. But it's a ice pack made specifically to go inside of vaginas. You can totally do whatever you want with maneuvering and MacGyvering your own kinds of ice packs for the vulva or inside the vagina. But there is something that's actually made for that and is totally safe, made with a medical grade resin. So that's an option, and that's actually really can be helpful with symptoms. I know a lot of folks recommend doing baths for relieving yeast and BV kind of irritation, but that heat is actually probably going to exacerbate the irritation for a lot of folks. Yep. Cooling is actually much better for symptom relief and reducing inflammation and irritation.
Yes. The few times I've had yeast infections and I've had that really uncomfortable kind of burning, let me tell you, like undies off and fan on is wonderful. Okay, so I would love for us to move into talking about herpes.
All right.
Yes, and you have posted snippets from some studies that you had been reading and encountering that were a little over a decade old, and your anger was just so wonderful. And one of the one of the things that you put was, yes, herpes is common, but we need to do a better job of educating everyone about the realities, risk, and do this in a destigmatizing, thoughtful, and inclusive way. And so I would love to know kind of what got you reading these studies about herpes, and what are some of the things that you've really started to kind of take away as you did that research?
Well, I guess it kind of overlaps with learning about lube, because a lot of the studies that I could find that really talked about the chemistry of lube and its interaction with the body focused on STIs and lubricants as a vehicle for microbicides that would limit the transmission of STIs. So I started learning a lot more about how actual viruses worked when I was doing that research. And then just kind of talking about STIs as part of my job, and the thing that really gets me is people's reaction to STIs, because, you know, I've read all these studies, and without even really focusing on STIs, I just came to kind of accept, like, oh, these are really common. People are getting STIs all the time. Some of them are curable. Some of them are lifelong, but it's a part of being a sexually active human. You just, like, part of being a human is kind of like interacting with folks and getting the cold, and stuff like that. That's what STIs are like when you start being sexually active. It's not that it's 100% inevitable, but it's more inevitable than not that you'll get an STI at some point. It's just part of the deal. And that seems really normal and kind of obvious to me after kind of seeing all these statistics over and over about how many folks have this STI and how many folks get infected with an STI every year and all that. And then I go and I talk to non-sex educator humans about it, and they are shocked and terrified and don't want to talk about it. And so I was really like, we got to do something to kind of bridge this gap in knowledge. And then I was diagnosed with herpes about a year ago, and I had a HSV-1 outbreak on my genitals, which means that HSV-1 is commonly referred to as oral herpes. And HSV stands for herpes simplex virus. And then HSV-2 is typically categorized as genital herpes, but you can get either virus on any mucous membrane on your body, pretty much. And I got a genital outbreak, and most likely I got it from a partner who occasionally had cold sores on their mouth, but we never did any sort of direct mucus-to-mucus contact when they had an active cold sore. So there are even holes in my herpes knowledge, because asymptomatic shedding when there is no obvious sore is very, very common. And oral-to-genital transmission of HSV-1 is also becoming more and more common in kind of a staggering way. It's something that's being documented in scientific journal publications that folks are really starting to pay attention to it, because it is really becoming more of an issue, and it's a risk that a lot of people don't identify when they're participating in those sexual activities, because folks don't realize that cold sores are herpes. Cold sores are HSV-1 or HSV-2 manifested on the mouth. So there's all these things. And then the process of me going to the hospital, getting diagnosed, talking to a doctor was traumatic and horrible. And as somebody who really advocates for good sexual health care and knows a lot about this stuff already, I was kind of just in shock at how uninformed my doctors were. They refused to give me the testing that I wanted because they told me that it wasn't worth it. And then I started talking to other folks that I knew had herpes about their diagnostic experience, their support that they got from healthcare professionals. And then I started talking to the healthcare professionals that I know that work in spaces that do diagnose STIs, and how are they trained and what are their attitudes around herpes in particular, but testing in general and risk assessment in general. And it's really, we're not in a good place about this right now. So I don't know the best way to make things better around this. I'm kind of still in the just gather as much information as I can stage. And I do really want to, I have a survey put together that I haven't finalized yet, but I do want to send out to folks who are living with an STI or have had an STI and their experience with diagnosis, because I think there is, especially around herpes, there's this huge discrepancy, because medical professionals know how common it is, don't think of it as a big deal, and they don't want to do the testing for herpes. They don't want to diagnose herpes because they know that their patients are going to have a pretty intense reaction to it, because it is so stigmatized in our culture. And they don't want to spend the time on it. They don't feel equipped to handle the emotional things that come up with it. And they, that like attitude around it is kind of just like, well, you're probably going to be fine. It's not going to be a big deal. And so there really isn't that like empathy and education and support there. because medical professionals aren't trained on how to do that. But also there isn't like a safety net built in. So if you go and you get a HIV diagnosis and receive a positive diagnosis, you go see an HIV counselor. And that's something that's built into that healthcare in most places. There's nothing like that for herpes. There's like a hotline you can call, and that's kind of it. And the folks that I know that are working in clinics that diagnose STIs right now have all said that reactions to a herpes diagnosis are this at the same level or much more intense and much more negative than that of an HIV diagnosis, because people don't understand the virus. They don't understand how it manifests. They're getting this kind of I could care less vibe from their doctor, which is not helping the matter at all. And there's so many holes in how the understanding of transmission works that they are often like struggling to understand how they got this STI, because they may have had it for a really long time. They may have gotten it in a really benign, non-sexual way. So it's really confusing for folks. And the support really isn't there. And then there's also the cases of herpes, especially HSV2 on the genitals, that are really not a little deal at all, that are actually a huge deal. And it's kind of like having a lifelong chronic illness that you have to maintain all the time that affects your immune system, that can affect your nervous system. And there's very few medical professionals that are really educated on the more severe cases of HSV2. And so those folks who are experiencing more severe symptoms are really being treated in the exact same way as anybody who maybe experiences some recurrent outbreaks with suppressive therapy. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't seem like that's enough. Yeah. And it also, there's just this lack of information about that kind of manifestation of herpes.
There's so much you said that I want to like dive into because it's so important.
Yeah.
You know, I think that one of the hardest things that comes with a herpes diagnosis or like genital warts is this stigma that comes with it. And the stigma is so terrifying that like I've known people who got a herpes diagnosis and then continued having unprotected sex with a partner without telling them because they were so terrified of what disclosing would mean about their value and losing their partner. And they were willing to not have that conversation and face the consequences of that versus just saying, I have this thing that I want to talk to you about. And I know I've had listeners write in who got a diagnosis of herpes and felt like they were never going to have sex again. They were never going to find somebody who loved them. And like, it's these devastating reactions that we have to navigate, and there's not a lot of support for it. And you're so right. Like when you actually start seeing the numbers of, I mean, the huge numbers of people who have some strain of either HSV1 or HSV2. There's this huge, huge, just like rift in like the number of people who have this and the number of people who feel like their life is over when they actually get the diagnosis, because doctors just kind of are like, oh, here's your results, leave.
Yep. That's exactly it. And I think that there's some really great resources that can help for kind of putting herpes in context of how many folks have it. And that's helpful to a point, you know, that helps in your like logical, impartial, objective brain, but you still have that emotional reaction to, oh, like I have this thing, it's incurable. And I think that a lot of how we teach sex education leads to that feeling. I think that there's the cultural element that is very pervasive, that's just kind of that really stigmatizes all STIs.
Yeah.
But I also think that we teach sex education in a way that doesn't help us out that much either, because it's still like, if you're a good person and if you're a responsible person, you'll do all the right stuff so you won't get STIs.
Right.
Like, I think that's kind of the message. And you can be the best person and you can have the most responsible, safer sex practices. But the truth is that barriers don't protect you from herpes or HPV 100% because those are passed through skin-to-skin contact. It doesn't matter that you're – I mean, it does matter that you're inhibiting fluid exchange, but that's not 100% protection from those STIs. So I think people have been misled when it comes to their sex education as far as what is actually reducing the risk of what. And kind of what is the level of risk that is just always present? I think that risk, especially in sex ed, is kind of presented as this negative thing.
Yeah.
But it's really just like part of the deal. It's part of the deal when you walk outside your house, like you risk getting hit by a car because, you know, it's just part of the deal of being a sexually active person.
Yeah.
And what you said about disclosure, too, is I think – that is something that I've heard from people I know. I've seen reflected in scientific studies that talk about the psychological impact of a herpes diagnosis. That's a common thing, is folks not knowing how to disclose, being terrified of disclosure, and then depending on how they understand the virus and how it's manifesting in their body and how they understand how the suppressive therapies and treatments can work. In the future, they may or may not tell other sexual partners because of how they perceive their own risk of transmitting the virus at that given time. And that's one thing that I didn't really understand until I really started looking into it, is that asymptomatic shedding is very, very common and can happen anytime. So even when you're not having an outbreak or your partner's not having an outbreak, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden that kind of activity is now risk-free. And if folks want to, there's a really, really great video that is a TED Talk about herpes by Ella Dawson.
Oh, it's so good.
And one thing that I really took from that TED Talk and I think is super duper important is what she says about how we need to, in sex education in particular, but I think as a culture as a whole, provide examples of people living their lives with STIs, people who have lifelong STIs and who are still sexually fulfilled, having a great time, living their life and doing what they want to do and managing their STIs and like living with them like other chronic illnesses. I don't think that there is a script for that person that is out there, but I know for a fact people who are living that right now, and I know those people, and I talk to people about their genitals all the time. So I'm someone that they'll tell that they're STI positive, but most folks don't talk about that. And so I think like we just all need to talk about it more, and help normalize that and help give folks examples of people who are having happy, healthy lives and have STIs, because you can be a healthy person and be STI positive.
Yes, I think that's so important. You know, I know one of the things that I see a lot, and I know I've been guilty of this in my like online dating profiles, is, you know, making a point to say like I only date people who are clean, or, you know, STI free, and just kind of making this distinction that if you're not clean, then you must be dirty. And I think that's very common in just the dialogue that we have. You're so right that a big part of the way we handle sex education, at least here in the US, is most of the time when we're talking about sex with young people, which, let's be honest, that's really the only point in our lives most of us get sex education, is it's very fear-based. And so it's don't get pregnant, don't get STIs. If you do, then you've done something wrong. And it comes with a lot of this, like, moral judgment and
definitely,
and you're kind of determining someone's value on whether or not they've managed to avoid pregnancy and avoid STIs. And so I love the suggestion of we need to really have examples of people who are living with STIs the same way you would live with a cancer diagnosis or a diabetes diagnosis. And, you know, I think that's a big, huge, like, flashing red light that just really points to this like puritanical undercurrent that we have still in our culture around sex, in that, you know, we celebrate people who are out in the world living lives and living with diabetes or living with asthma or living with, you know, whatever it is. But then as soon as something is attached to sex, it suddenly takes on this whole new meaning about your worth as a human and how, you know, how can you show your face? Who's going to love you? And I think that that's just, I mean, it just speaks to these much broader issues that we have around. We don't even know how to talk about sex just in a very basic way with the people in our lives. So then you have to think about how much more difficult it is for people to talk about something as personal as STIs.
Right. And that's even an issue with medical professionals. There's a lot of studies on how medical professionals talk about STIs and talk to patients about STIs during a diagnosis. And a lot of them indicate that not the majority, but still a fair amount of doctors also pass that judgment on to their patients. And that is unacceptable in a place where you need like those objective facts and need to learn how to take care of yourself. That's not what's happening with the relationship with medical professionals. But I think, yes, as like a whole society, there needs to be kind of a whole shift about how we look at STIs. And I think this goes back to what I said earlier about how kind of people's common sense ends at their genitals.
Yeah.
I think that I don't know the best way for this to happen. But I think that folks really need to, I mean, I think that seeing the information that's out there, seeing the data and the statistics around STIs, can be really helpful. And that's what works for how my brain works. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that other examples will work better for other folks. But just really see that STIs, are really no different than other kinds of illnesses that you can catch out in the world. And they don't have so much shame and stigma associated. And it is different than something like cancer or diabetes, because with an STI or some sort of virus or infection, it's based off of your behavior.
Yeah.
It's based off of like the situations that you put yourself in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of where, I mean, the puritanical roots of our culture play into it. But I think that's part of why there's this kind of moral judgment and this character assessment that goes along with an STI diagnosis. But I think people really need to understand that most people who have STIs don't know they have STIs. The most common symptom of an STI is no symptoms. Hmm. So you can be doing everything right. You can be with a monogamous partner who thinks that they're doing everything right, and one of you could have had an STI for years and not known it and transmitted it to the other person.
Yeah.
You know, so like there's no way to concretely figure out what handshake got you to having the flu.
right.
You know, you can't like track down that person and then somehow not have the flu anymore. And you just kind of have to go with it and go with the fact that you expose your body to health risks all the time. And this is just another one of those things.
I honestly could talk about this for so much longer because there's just so many other thoughts that I have that I want to make sure all of our listeners like take away. But I know we're at the end of our hour and I want to respect your time. And you've been so generous in just sharing all of your research and the things that you've learned with us. So I would love it if you would share with everybody how they can find you online and stay in touch and follow along with the classes you're creating and all that good stuff.
Yeah, well, you can check out the Smitten Kitten at www.smittenkittenonline.com. And we do have an events calendar up on our website that you can check out. Most of the events that I do are around the Twin Cities, but I'm going to be doing some more webinars in the coming months. So I'm really excited about that and making that accessible to anybody anywhere. You can also get information about that at the Smitten Kitten's Facebook page, which is just search the Smitten Kitten on Facebook. You'll find us. And if you want to get in touch with me, I do social media, but the best way is just to email me, especially if you have questions specific to one of the things that we talked about today. So you can email me at Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at smittenkittenonline.com.
Awesome. So we will have all of those links on sexgetsreal.com for this episode. So you can easily check out Smitten Kitten and find Sarah's email address. And of course, to all of our listeners who wrote in, thank you so much, and who listened, thank you so much. You can also head to sexgetsreal.com to fill out the contact form if you've got any questions or stories or comments that you'd like me to tackle in an upcoming episode. And also be sure to follow along Sex Gets Real on Twitter, where we have all kinds of goodness, articles and studies like the ones that Sarah finds and shares all over our social media. So be sure to follow us there. Thank you so much for listening. This is Dawn Sarah, and I will talk to you next week.